From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. How about you, Old Devil Moon, on a clear day? Just a few of the songs composed by Burton Lane. On this edition of Fresh Air, Burton Lane talks about the songs he's written and the lyricists he wrote them with. Also today, we talk with sculptor Dwayne Hansen, creator of statues so realistic they're often mistaken for people. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from singer and actress Abby Lincoln. And reporter Stefan Salisbury brings us up to date on the continuing controversy over government funding of the arts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. and Saudi officials said today that they've come to an agreement on operational command of the multinational forces in any possible military action against Iraq. The question of who will command and control the forces had been a sensitive matter for the Saudis, for whom the deployment has been largely a matter of self-defense. Under the agreement, U.S. and Saudi forces would operate under a joint command in defense of the kingdom. Outside of Saudi Arabia, U.S. troops would be led by American commanders after the operation was approved at the highest political levels of both governments. For the past month, the United Nations Security Council has gone through several heated debates on Israel's use of violence against Palestinians in Jerusalem and the occupied territories. Now, a new reprimand of Israel is expected. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
The PLO is pressing for a new Security Council resolution that would take tough measures against Israel if it refused to open its doors to a UN observer force that would monitor human rights in the occupied territories. The resolution, backed by the PLO's third world supporters on the council, calls for the immediate establishment of a multinational team in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and Jerusalem. Israel has so far rejected such a move, but the resolution also provides for enforcement measures against the Jewish state if it does not change its policy. Tomorrow, the Security Council is expected to consider a report delivered last week by Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar on the protection of Palestinians. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir easily wrote out a parliamentary threat to his government today. Shamir faced a vote of no confidence over his administration's handling of massive immigration by Soviet Jews and a worsening housing shortage. Felix Bloch, the career diplomat suspected of espionage, has been fired by the State Department. George Getter reports.
Secretary of State Baker took the action because of what he said were Bloch's deliberate false statements to the FBI during the course of a national security investigation. Also cited were Bloch's behavior, activities, and associations. There was no further elaboration. The 55-year-old specialist in European affairs had been under investigation since early last year on suspicion of passing secrets to the Soviet Union. No charges were ever filed for lack of an ironclad case against Bloch. Investigators believed Bloch was recruited to spy for the Soviets in 1974. Electronic surveillance was reported to have picked up Bloch telling his wife last year that he had accepted payments from the Soviets. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 11 points today to close at 2,502.23. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The songs How About You, Old Devil Moon, Everything I Have Is Yours, I Hear Music, Too Late Now, What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life, and You're My Thrill were written by my guest Burton Lane. Many of his songs were composed for movies, but he wrote some of his best-known melodies for the Broadway shows Finian's Rainbow and On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. He's collaborated with some of the great lyricists of his time, including Ira Gershwin, Yip Harburg, and Frank Lesser. Some of Lane's best-known songs, and some obscure ones, are included on the new record Michael Feinstein Sings the Burton Lane Songbook. What makes the record special is that the 77-year-old composer is featured at the piano accompanying Feinstein. The song they open with is one that Lane wrote with lyricist Ira Gershwin for the 1953 film Give a Girl a Break. Lane and Gershwin made a demo recording of the song in 1953, with Gershwin singing his lyrics and Lane at the piano. We'll hear the verse from that original recording, then segue into the new recording featuring Lane and Feinstein.
When the voodoo drum is drumming, or the hummingbird is humming, does it thrill you? Does it fill you with delight? To continue with this jingle, are you one of those who tingle to your shoesies at the bluesies in the night? Oh, the sounds of bugles calling, or Niagara Falls a-falling, may enchant you, we will grant you that they might. But for us on the stage, oh brother, there's just one sound and no other. Applause, applause, we like applause because it means when it is striking us, the audience is liking us. Our work demands you don't sit on your hands, and if the hand's tremendous, you send us. We live, we thrive, you keep us all alive. With bravo and bravissimo, we're dead if it's pianissimo. Our quirk is work, is work we never shirk, in a happy land of tinsel and gauze. Because we like applause.
Britt and Lane, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell me a little what it was like to record with Ira Gershwin.
Well, working with Ira was a dream. He was a wonderful, wonderful person. I can tell you, would you like me to tell you a little story about how this came about?
Absolutely.
Ira was known for turning down assignments. When I had the offer, when I was received the offer from Irving Lazar that MGM wanted me to do a score for a film, he said, who would you like to work with? I said, I'll give you two names because I know my first choice will turn the assignment down. I said, my first choice is Ira Gershwin, and then I gave him a second choice. 2 days later, I got a call that Ira had accepted the assignment. And I, of course, I was thrilled. I had known the Gershwin since I was 17 or 16 years old, and this would be the first time that I would be working with this giant. And as the day approached for me to start work with him, I started to get very nervous about the whole thing. I was wondering, am I up to this? Am I good enough to work with a man like Ira? The day I was to meet him, I took a sedative to calm my nerves. I was that shaken and that nervous at the prospect. When I got to his house, we engaged in some trifling, just very flimsy conversation just to get kind of loosened up a little bit. And I sat down, played a couple of melodies for him. And as the hour wore on, I started to feel more comfortable. And I said to him, Ira, I have a confession to make. I was so nervous at the prospect of working with you that this morning I had to take a sedative. Ira reached into his pocket, took out a pill box. He said, I had to take one too.
You said that you met the Gershwins when you were 17 years old. How did you meet them?
Well, my folks used to take, my father used to take my brother and me and my mother to Atlantic City over a holiday weekend or a holiday week, like Christmas and New Year's. And we were having dinner at a very modest hotel in Atlantic City. My father was a person who, when he saw a piano, he would say, Bert, play, and I would cringe. And he saw a piano. It was an upright piano that was facing a wall, and the people who were having dinner would be looking at the back of whoever was playing. And he finally used enough pressure for me to go to the piano. I said, I'll do it if you sit alongside of me. So he was sitting, facing out into the room, and I was facing the piano, which was against this wall, an upright. When I hear a woman's voice saying to my father, is this your son? And he said, yes. And she said, my name is Rose Gershwin. I'm George Gershwin's mother. I was attracted to your son's playing because he sounds like George. And when I looked to see who was playing, he looked like George from the back. And it was this introduction which led to Mrs. Gershwin calling us when we got back to New York and inviting us to an open house to meet Ira and George, which happened. And it was a very meaningful meeting for me.
Songwriter Burton Lane is my guest. Your songwriting career starts at around age 15 when you were signed to a Tin Pan Alley music company. What was the job exactly?
Actually, my first contract was with the Schuberts. They were producers of Broadway shows. J.J. Schubert had heard some of the songs I had written and signed the chap I was working with, who happened to be my brother's friend, who was going to law school at the time, to write the score for a Greenwich Village Follies starring James Barton. Barton got sick and the show never happened, but we wrote a score for it. Later, as soon as that was over, I was introduced to the head of Remix Music Publishing Company. I was signed to a contract, a songwriter's contract, in which I got $17.50 advance each week. George Gershwin had also been signed by Remix, and he got $15 a week. So I was getting more than George got.
How old were you?
I was 15.
So did you work by assignment? Were you told what kinds of songs were needed, or were you just supposed to churn out songs?
No, I was just supposed to turn out melodies, which I did. None of them were I think I only had one song published. I remember the first song I ever wrote was called Broken Butterfly. But I can't tell you how it goes. I've forgotten.
Was it the song publisher who suggested changing your name from Levy to Lane?
No, that was a radio executive, a broadcasting executive. I can't remember. Was it NBC or CBS? When he heard me play, I don't remember why I played for him or what the intention was. My father took me to play for him. That's all I remember. And he said, I think it would be a good idea if you change your name. I don't think it made any difference. I think I could have stayed with the name Levy and done as well as I've done with Lane.
How did you get to Hollywood?
Irving Berlin's publishing firm signed Harold Adamson, wonderful lyric writer, and me on a six-week deal to see if we could get some songs in pictures. And it was his firm, Irving Berlin's firm, which sent me to California with Harold.
And what was the first movie you did?
My first movie was Dancing Lady. Now, I didn't write any songs for Dancing Lady. Metro purchased three songs that we already had written. And it was also Fred Astaire's first picture. And the picture starred Joan Crawford, Clark Gable, Fran Chateau. And Fred Astaire was just starting out as a performer in films. He had been a star on Broadway, but nobody knew him in the picture business.
The song that was used for that movie, well, one of the songs that was used for that movie, was Everything I Have Is Yours.
That's right.
Beautiful song. And who in the movie sang it?
It was sung by Arthur Jarrett, who was the current big singer, such as Bing Crosby was at that time. He had his own radio show, and he was the one who sang the song. And the song, everybody knows, Everything I Have Is Yours, You're Part of Me. I got a call one day shortly after the song was purchased, and I was asked if I could think of something for Joan Crawford to do in the song because she was dancing with Clark Gable by the bandstand, and as she danced by, they wanted her to have something to sing. And I thought of a little phrase, da-da-da, da-da-da-da, which she hummed, and that became part of the song. And all the orchestrations that came out at that time, going back 1933, had that little phrase that she hummed in the picture.
One of the things that happened shortly after you got to Hollywood was that you heard a young girl who turned out to be Judy Garland sing, and you kind of discovered her and played for her audition.
Yes, I did.
What did it mean to discover her? Where did you hear her, and what did you like about what you heard?
I was on the contract to Metro. This is 1934. And one night I went down to downtown Los Angeles to the Paramount Theater, where there was a film and a stage show on the bill were the Gum Sisters, and they were two young women, I guess 19 and 21, something like that. For a finale of their act, they brought out their kid sister, who was 11 years old, Frances Gum, who sang two songs. Zing Went the Strings of My Heart, which was a very good song, and a Hebrew melody which had been done by many people in vaudeville called Ailey Ailey. And she was just wonderful, so wonderful, I thought, that I went out into the lobby of the theater and I called the head of the music department. This was at night, and I called him at his home, told him about this young girl, and he said, well, see if you can arrange to have her brought out to the studio. We'll audition her, which I did. I went backstage. I met her father, arranged for her to be brought out to the studio the following week, and she arrived about 9 o'clock in the morning. I took her over to the office of the head of the music department. I played her audition, and the audition went from about 9 to about 7 or 7:30 that evening, because after Jack Robbins, who was head of the music department, heard her, he called L.B. Mayer, Louis B. Mayer, who was the head of the studio. Mayer came down with an entourage of people. We went through the numbers again. He said, I want every director, every writer, every producer to hear this child immediately. And that's how we spent the day. I played her audition. We must have gone over these numbers 15 or 16 times until everybody who was intended to hear her heard her. The next thing I knew, of course, she was signed. They loaned her out. And some peculiar way, I didn't see Judy for 7 years. After a year or so, I was let out. I went over to Paramount for a couple of years. And in 1941, was brought back to Metro to write the score for Babes on Broadway, starring two great stars, Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. So Judy became, in those 7 years, became a great big star.
One of your best-known songs is from that movie, and I'm thinking of How About You?
Yes, it was sung by Mickey and Judy, and of course they did it beautifully.
But I want to play you playing it from the new album that you recorded with Michael Feinstein, and there's about a 2-minute piano solo that opens this recording of it. Do you want to say anything about performing this for the new record?
Well, in the film, Ralph Fiedler wrote the lyrics, and I wrote a patter which came between the first chorus and the third and the second chorus. And it was Michael Feinstein who remembered this and suggested that I do a piano solo of that patter, which I recorded on the record. And I think it was an interesting idea, and I think it turned out very well.
Well, I do too. Why don't we hear it? Composer Burton Lane at the piano playing his own song, How About You? You know, there's so many times when I thought, oh, this must be a Gershwin song, because the line, I like a Gershwin tune, How About You?
That was my line.
Was it really? Yeah. Oh. You know, the one problem with that line is that it makes you think Gershwin.
Well, you should. It was the whole idea. So, I mean, when you're listing the things that are important to you, I like New York in June, How About You? I like a Gershwin tune. What tune would be more important than a Gershwin tune?
So how'd you come up with the line? And why did you come up with the line? Someone else wrote the lyric. Who wrote the lyric for that?
Ralph Fried. It just popped into my head, that's all, and I blurted it out. And, of course, Ralph liked it immediately.
I think it's the best-known line from the song.
Well, I'm delighted with that.
You're featured on piano on the new record. I wonder how much have you performed over the years?
Well, I have. I'm not really a performer. I have performed for. On a board of ASCAP, and on occasions they've had affairs where they've asked me to do a medley, and I've done that. Or when we're honoring one of our colleagues, I'll do one of his or her songs. But I've never really been a performing songwriter.
I love your playing. I wonder if you've wanted to play more in public over the years.
Well, I'm not one who, up until now, has enjoyed performing too much. I tremble at the idea. I'm always afraid I'll forget the lyrics or hit a bad note or something. I worry before I go on.
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is composer Burton Lane, and he's written the score for several Broadway shows, including Finian's Rainbow and On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. He accompanies Michael Feinstein on the new album. Michael Feinstein sings the Burton Lane songbook, and some of Lane's best-known songs, such as How About You and Old Devil Moon, are featured on here, as well as some lesser-known songs and even a couple of new ones. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Burton Lane is my guest. You've worked with a lot of different lyricists. With each lyricist, did you have a different way of working?
No, not really. Mostly, I would write melodies first. Yip Harburg was not one who would write a lyric first. He would give me a title. For instance, in Finian's Rainbow, the title, When I'm Not Near the Girl I Love the Girl I'm Near, came first. With Alan Lerner, I would sometimes he would give me a few lines of lyric or a title, and I would write to the title. But most of the times, it's been music first. With Ira Gershwin, I think the lyric of Applause, Applause, he wrote that lyric first, and I said it. And but most of the times, I would say it's music first.
Were there any lyrics written for any of your songs that you were frankly unhappy with?
Well, I think there were, but I don't think they wouldn't be published. I wouldn't let them get out. You know, when you're working with a lyric writer, of course one has to be gentle and considerate because they're trying to do a good job. But if it isn't right, you have to be honest with one another. One of the first things I say to any lyric writer I start working with, we must be absolutely honest. I don't want to be yesed into a flop. If you don't like a melody, tell me. If there's some part of the melody you don't like, I'll change it. And I must have the same freedom with lyrics. And that's usually agreed to without any problem.
Did this new record with Michael Feinstein bring you out of retirement?
I've never retired.
I wasn't sure about that.
Well, I'm sure. I've never stopped writing. I've always kept writing, and I think it's important. I remember once during the Depression when things were rough, or actually it was a recession in Hollywood, and it was so discouraging to sit down and write because I couldn't get a job. And I remember when I finally did get one, it was very difficult to start the creative juices flowing, and I think it's just like an athlete. You must keep in shape, and so when I've learned that lesson, I've never stopped writing. In fact, on the album, there are a couple of new songs, and I'm very proud of those songs.
Was there a period where you felt that Broadway or musical movies had changed sufficiently so as to kind of leave you out?
No, I don't think so. One of my problems has been finding a lyric writer that I could really team up with. I remember many times I tried to convince Yip Harburg that when you're a team, you grow together, you have a continuity of work together, and I think that's important. All one has to do is look at the careers of Richard Rodgers, who had a long career with Larry Hart, and then when That broke up and Larry died. He had Oscar Hammerstein. And it was after Oscar died that Dick was in the same situation that most of us are in who don't have a team. He wrote with many writers, never really found a mate, so to speak. So that's one of the problems that I personally have, is not having a steady lyric writer.
But you'd like to have one if you could.
Oh, yes, I would, sure.
I should ask you before we wrap up, how did this collaboration between you and Michael Feinstein happen?
Well, it was Michael's idea. He came to me with this idea. We have been friends. Actually, I knew that Michael had worked for Ira Gershwin, but I never had a chance to meet him until there was a memorial service for Ira in New York, and Michael was there, and I met him that day, and we became friends. And when he would come into New York, we'd meet and spend a couple of hours together around a piano. He would sing, I would play. And it was Michael's idea that I join him in an album. And I said, well, Michael, you know, you do so well for yourself when you're playing. Why do you need me? He said, well, this is what I'd like to do. And that's how it happened.
Is this album changing your life in any way?
I think it's on the verge of changing it. I appeared at the Golden Theater on three occasions. Michael had asked me to do this. And the reaction of the audience was so overwhelming that it kind of shook me up. One of the things I realize is that when we write songs that people like, that those songs are making friends for us, and we as the writers don't know who these people are until we appear before them. And it was just an amazing experience. So I don't know. This experience might change my future life, yes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and I also want to thank you for writing so many great songs. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Burton Lane, the composer, and you can hear him as a pianist as well as a composer on his new album with Michael Feinstein called Michael Feinstein Sings the Burton Lane Songbook, Volume 1, which means there's going to be a Volume 2, right?
I hope so. The songs are already recorded, and they're in the wings, ready to go.
Good luck with it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Something in your eyes I see soon begins bewitching me. It's that old devil moon that you stole from the skies. It's that old devil moon in your eyes. You and your glass make this romance too hot to handle. Stars in the night, blazing their light, can't hold a candle to your razzle-dazzle. You've got me flying high and wide on a magic carpet ride, full of butterflies inside.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dwayne Hanson's sculptures of men and women are perfect in every detail, from the pores of the skin to the real clothes in which he dresses his creations. Coming up, Dwayne Hanson on realism that does more than just fool people. Critic Kevin Whitehead calls Abby Lincoln one of the few great living jazz singers. Kevin reviews Lincoln's new album. And the Advisory Council of the National Endowment for the Arts met over the weekend. Reporter Stephen Salisbury tells us what went on. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Jessica Berman. Secretary of State James Baker reached an agreement today with Saudi King Fahd on the command of troops should they be sent into combat against Iraq and the Persian Gulf. A senior Bush administration official says the soldiers would be under U.S. command outside the kingdom. Within Saudi Arabia, they'd be under joint U.S.-Saudi command. Baker is trying to forge agreements on how to proceed in the event of a military operation against Iraq. On the last day of the campaign, President Bush is in Texas stumping for the GOP slate. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
In his adopted home state of Texas, the president seems to be enjoying being on his home turf and getting a chance to campaign on behalf of Republican gubernatorial candidate Clayton Williams. Williams is running against Democrat Ann Richards, who last gained the national spotlight with her disparaging remarks about Mr. Bush at the 1988 Democratic National Convention. Today, the president shot back.
In case anybody asking, where's George? I'm here in Smith County working for a man that I believe in, that I've known for a long time, that will be a great governor of this state, Clayton Williams.
The president also urged his audience to ignore polls that indicate Americans are in a pessimistic mood on election eve. The president shouted, "Don't tell me what's wrong with this country. Show me what's right. Get out and do your civic duty." I'm Richard Gonzalez with the president in Tyler, Texas.
The first black to be nominated for governor by a major party in South Carolina is headed for resounding defeat in tomorrow's elections. Polls show Democrat Theo Mitchell trailing incumbent Republican Carol Campbell by 40% or more. Mitchell made race an issue in the campaign and in the process seems to have alienated many voters. NPR's David Mulpis reports.
The Democratic Party in South Carolina is in disarray, and many state officials are placing much of the blame on Democratic gubernatorial challenger Theo Mitchell. He says some Democrats were out to sabotage his campaign, but analysts say much of the damage was self-inflicted. Some white party leaders say Mitchell never asked for their help and that he was too liberal for South Carolina. Never well organized or financed, Mitchell's efforts virtually collapsed in September after he called some of Campbell's black supporters, quote, black prostitutes, Uncle Toms, and house niggers, end quote. Mitchell's defenders say such outbursts are the product of deep-seated rage in the black community, and they praise his calls for radical political change. Polls suggest at least 25% of blacks now plan to vote Republican. I'm David Malpas reporting.
A new ABC News poll finds an overwhelming number of Americans believe the nation's economy is worsening and they're unhappy with how President Bush and Congress are dealing with the problem. By a margin of 61% to 36%, those surveyed say they disapprove with the way the president is handling the economy. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 11 points to 2502. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Later, reporter Stephen Salisbury tells us what happened when the Major Advisory Council of the National Endowment for the Arts met in Washington over the weekend. Abby Lincoln began her career in the 1950s as a supper club singer, a line of work in which it may be more important to look good than sound good. After she met jazz drummer Max Roach, she was reborn as a politically conscious jazz singer. Lincoln's also had a modest Hollywood career, starring in the films Nothing But a Man and For the Love of Ivy in the 1960s. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says she's one of his favorite singers.
People walking round, living in the days, high above the ground with their snooty ways, putting people down, acting phony while they fly high.
Singing lyrics well demands a measure of acting talent. So it figures that Abby Lincoln, who was last seen on screen in Mo' Better Blues, is one of the handful of great living jazz singers. Lincoln can put over a lyric so well, she keeps you from noticing how bad some of the words she sings really are. Check out this tune's weak opening lines.
When lonely feelings chill, If winter comes, can spring be far behind? Beneath the deepest snows, the secret of a rose is merely that it knows you must believe in spring.
Lincoln put so much emotion into that Michelle LeGrand song. She makes you forget she had to get through the phrase, the meadows of your mind, in order to do it. When Abby Lincoln was first starting out, she got some timely encouragement from Billie Holiday. And in many ways, she's Holiday's successor. In fact, at one time, she was up for the role of Holiday in the movie Lady Sings the Blues. The part wound up going to Diana Ross, who was almost as awful as the movie script was. But that's another story. Like Billie Holiday, Abby Lincoln has an odd way of selling a song by flattening out its melody. She brings it closer to the contours of speech. Also like Holiday, she made her reputation as a jazz singer with records featuring great jazz players. On Lincoln's new album, The World is Falling Down, her rhythm section includes bassist Charlie Hayden and drummer Billy Higgins. The horn soloists are trumpeter Clark Terry and alto saxophonist Jackie McLean.
The struggle here is won. I will find a new dimension in the rising sun.
That's a little of Lincoln's song, I Got Thunder and It Rings. Abby Lincoln is like Billie Holiday in one more way, too. Both have been praised for singing stark material, but are at their best on upbeat stuff. Too many singers who strive for enthusiasm wind up gushing like cheerleaders. But the joy in Lincoln's music is more profound. She knows the world can be rough, but she's prepared to be defiant. Lincoln even brings a sense of cheerful resignation to her own song about mortality, The World is Falling Down. The sarcastically bluesy horn section and Clark Terry's wah-wah trumpet solo get the mood exactly right. Here's a good long excerpt.
There are some folks I used to know, used to smile and say hello. Spin the world and turn the page, entertaining from the stage. But Father Time forever true, loves its own and me and you. Disappear just like the sun when the day is done. The world is falling down, hold my hand. It's a lonely sound. Hold my hand. We'll follow the breeze and go like the wind and look for a place where the window's been. World is falling down. Hold my hand. Hold my hand. Hold my hand. Hold my hand.
The two tunes Abby Lincoln wrote are the highlights of her new album. It's not like they're the only good stuff, but this is one of those records where the best songs are so good, the weak ones don't matter. That's a little like the way Lincoln's singing works. As she's aged, the range of notes she can hit is narrowed, and her breath control isn't perfect. But when she's inspired, she makes you forget her technical shortcomings. You don't hear her limits. You just hear the music.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Abby Lincoln's new album, The World Is Falling Down, on Verve.
The darkest night would shine if you come to me soon. Until you will, I'll steal my heart, I'll hide the moon.
This is Fresh Air. I once went up to a Dwayne Hansen sculpture and asked it a question. It was a life-size sculpture of a museum guard, but I thought it was a real museum guard. I'm hardly the first person to make that mistake with a Dwayne Hansen sculpture. In fact, once a museum guard, after closing, went up to a sculpture of a man and asked it to leave. When there was no response, the guard called the police. Hansen creates these realistic figures by making body casts of the people who model for him. But what makes the statues look so real is Hansen's uncanny eye for clothing his figures, doing their hair, and giving them the perfect props. A show of his work just completed an American tour and is on its way to Europe. I spoke to Hansen over the summer when his show opened at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. Hansen told me museum goers often mistake his sculptures for real people.
They take on a life of their own, and then, I used to get a little upset about that because I consider my work sort of serious work, and then they take it, all the funny things happen, but this is part of dealing with it.
But your work isn't really about fooling people.
No, of course not. And it's about sculpture, first of all, and then communicating my ideas about the human condition in this society.
What I especially like about your work is that each piece seems to be a character study of that person. It's not just a realistic rendering where you go like, boy, that looks real. I mean, you stare at the person and you feel you have a sense of what their character is. And the character is given to you both from the facial expression and through the way you've combed their hair and found their clothes and painted their complexion.
That's well stated. I really appreciate that. That's really what it's about. It's not exactly, well, it has something to do with portraiture, but it goes beyond that. It goes examining the character, like you say, of the individual to express that alienation or frustration or that fatigue or that sort of emptiness or just immersed in their own thoughts in some way.
I know when I went into the museum, the first thing I started to do was, the first piece I saw was the two tourists, and I went up to them real close, closer than I'd get to any person. Mm-hmm. And I'm like looking at the pores in their face and, looking like the label on their shopping bag and, well, I wonder what camera that is. And, I'm really giving them not just the once-over, but I'm like inspecting, the hairs growing out of their hands and stuff. And I think this is something you've talked about, how we all really want to stare at people, but in real life, there's a limit to how close you can get.
It's a taboo, really. And people can do that here and derive some enjoyment of really studying another person. Driving over here to the station today, I noticed a couple of sculptures that I like to do. There was a policeman at a construction site or whatever. He had a big, burly guy. And with the blue shirt and the cap, the uniform they have here in Philadelphia. And his arms are folded like he's really in an authoritative, he's watching out that, you better watch out. I mean, those things I are imprinted on my brain for months, years sometimes. I said, I got to do that. I got to get to do that.
When someone catches your attention and you know you want to do a sculpture of them, what's the next step?
Well,
is that the way it works, that you see somebody who you want to do?
I have an idea in my head that I've got, a whole list of things that I think would be important to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like I have an idea of a baseball player now, and I'll get at the model. Model's coming down, And we take Polaroid shots in different positionings, and I pick the best one, and then the model stands in that position. We do molds of the legs and the body and the arms and the head. I have these molds that are filled with plastic material Bondo, body fillers that they use when you dent your car. The body shops fix your car with this stuff. I use that to cast the material into the out of the molds, and that's assembled. And the forms never come out right for me, so I improve them. Maybe the cheeks sunk in, or the nose got pressed in. I build up the nostrils. I fix around the eyes. Stuff that doesn't come around. That's, you know, that's the sculpturing.
Let's take one of the people in the current show, Queenie, who is the janitor.
Yeah.
Was the woman who you actually cast a janitor herself? In other words, do you do you cast?
Sometimes
the
they are
who,
what they are portrayed, but usually more interested in the physical presence of that person, like acting in a play, playing a part.
So you cast somebody in the role.
But it probably derives from somebody I've seen like that.
Right.
But, I mean, you can't grab people off the street, I mean, especially when you're traveling around and get them. So I get the next best solution to that
You find
idea.
Someone who looks like them.
Yeah, right.
Do you shop for clothes when it's time to dress one of your statues?
Oh, yes, that's very important, and it's frustrating sometimes. Sometimes the models will give me clothes from their own wardrobe, you know, things that they don't want or something that I can buy from them that I know that they'll fit, you know. And also, if they don't have the right attire, I go shopping, and if it's something colorful, I go to Kmart and get the right size. And something would be too, you know, wrong color, the right size, but the wrong color. And I've shopped around for sometimes a week. I sometimes go to the Goodwill or in places where they sell used clothing to get that worn effect. So that's very important to, to get the right clothing. It's sometimes frustrating, too.
Do you ever take a statue with you to make sure that the clothes are going to fit?
No, I don't scare people, I think.
You must have learned a lot about complexions, painting complexions.
Oh, yeah. The skin tone is to look like it's almost translucent. The coloring is just, we use a base coat and then a little bit airbrushing on top. Some of them are painted by hand, and they don't turn out quite as well. They have more of a makeup look. It's so delicate. And, you know, some complexions are more, more yellow, and some more pink. And black people, there's a lot of yellow, a lot of red, and a lot of kind of a Mars brown color.
There's a self-portrait in your current show. Yeah. It's a self-portrait with model. And it's a sculpture of you at what looks like a luncheonette table.
Right.
And sitting across the table from you is a woman in a blue and white checked house dress. The house dress is sleeveless, and in the back, her brassiere is sticking out through the sleeveless armhole.
She noticed that.
Yeah. She's pretty overweight.
Yes.
She's reading Arthritis magazine and eating a sundae. There's a copy of Woman's Day sitting on the table also. Tell me about this, the scene that this comes from.
Well, I wanted to do a self-portrait, and I didn't want to do an ordinary kind where in art history you see the artist holding a brush, obviously looking into a mirror and painting himself, and or a sculptor carving out something. I wanted to be portrayed as an observer, because that's what I do, basically, more than anything else, and that the work is derived from that. You know, every artist has to do self-portrait sooner or later, or wants to do it, or I'm sort of glad I did it.
You were, I think, about 42 when you started doing realist sculpture. Were you doing mostly abstraction before that?
No, I never really got into it. I never felt comfortable with doing abstract work. It was representational work. You could see it was a figure. It was modified to, you know, maybe design, maybe. The features weren't all there, but the part of the character was there, part of the composition was there, and it was carved out of wood or stone or modeled in clay. And I came to the conclusion that, so what? You know, I do this and can do this, but it doesn't really say anything about the human condition. These are works by themselves, each individual one. You have to have sort of a concept of a body of work that will convey, communicate some ideas, some concepts which you have in your head, I think. And that's what I got into when I got into realism and when pop art came to be accepted, and then realism seemed to be legitimate again. I got into it, and then one thing led to another. I did 67, I guess it was, a group of four dead shoulders and one dying to express my protests about the war in Vietnam. I did a race riot, about five sculptures in that, and then moved to New York in 1969. I did a group of derelicts off the Bowery. And then that evolved into more critical types with my first tourists and dressed out in rather outlandish attire, a supermarket shopping lady with her cart, and now I do more illusionistic types, not so much manipulating of exaggeration and so on of the subject.
When I look at your sculptures, I feel like I recognize everybody. I've seen people who I know or who I've met who are very much like them. I wonder if you feel sometimes in art that we're still not quite at the point where a lot of just like real people, ordinary people, are represented. I mean, I wonder if you still feel that mostly in art, people are still idealized.
Oh, I think you're right, yeah. And I think that's one of the major attractions to my work, that these are people that they've seen, that they know, that they recognize, and that they really have come to life.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Artist Wayne Hansen. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what kind of election previews do you have for us?
Well, we'll hear a report from Cokie Roberts on the Oregon Senate race, where Mark Hatfield, the incumbent Republican, has faced a very stiff re-election campaign this year. Also, Linda Wertheimer checks in with reporters around the country where there are some interesting congressional races. From the Soviet Union, we'll hear about why 13 leading economists have criticized Gorbachev's economic reform plan, two of them economists very close to Gorbachev. And we'll also hear about a new book on the KGB, which describes the period in the early 1980s when the Soviets took very seriously the threat of an American missile attack.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The National Council on the Arts, the largest advisory panel of the National Endowment for the Arts, held its quarterly meeting in Washington over the weekend. At each meeting, they review hundreds of grant applications, divvy up millions of dollars, and discuss federal arts policy. This meeting provided the first glimpse of the endowment since Congress passed reauthorization legislation late last month. That legislation removed obscenity restrictions from federally funded work, but it did give the agency the power to get its money back if a work they funded is ruled obscene by the courts. Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Stephen Salisbury has been covering the NEA story. The last time the council met in August, it refused to approve several grants to controversial artists such as Karen Finley and Holly Hughes. The meeting was disrupted by protesters. Stephen, you attended the council meeting over the weekend. What was the mood?
Quiet, I think. There was a small demonstration on Saturday mounted by artists and gay activists who see serious problems with the new endowment legislation. But the anger and emotion that bubbled over at the last meeting in August were definitely gone. I'd say they've been replaced by a kind of weariness or wariness on the part of the arts community. Also, this time around, the council approved a couple of grants to Finley and Hughes. Those were the same grants they refused to approve in August, which really angered a lot of artists and arts representatives at the time, but it allowed the endowment to avoid irritating some key congressmen then.
So if the endowment no longer has obscenity restrictions and the National Council is now approving grants to controversial artists like Karen Finley and Holly Hughes, why are people still demonstrating?
Well, there are several reasons, really. First, the legislation passed by Congress requires the endowment to consider, quote, general standards of decency, unquote, when it awards grants. No one really knows what that means. Secondly, the legislation requires a number of internal administrative changes that will substantially alter the endowment's operations in unforeseen ways. For instance, there are going to be stringent reporting requirements for grants, and many artists and arts representatives feel that those reporting requirements will substantially reduce the number of individual artists' fellowships given by the endowment. Thirdly, the new reauthorization legislation increases the amount of funding that the endowment must provide to state arts agencies. That'll have a significant impact on what the endowment itself can fund. The council and endowment officials are so bemused by all this that they're holding a special retreat to try to figure it all out.
So the controversy isn't over yet.
No. Most of the power remains in the hands of the endowment chairman. At the moment, that happens to be John Frohnmayer, and a lot will depend on how he interprets the new legislation. Frohnmayer makes the final decision, for instance, on whether Finley and Hughes will get the grants recommended this weekend by the council. He hasn't decided what he'll do yet. In general, I think the arts face a much more difficult time now because of all this. Private funders and the endowment are skittish about possible controversies. Movies and pop music are under attack around the country. It appears this isn't over at all. The story just seems to be shifting from Washington out to the rest of the country.
Thanks, Stefan. Stefan Salisbury covers cultural affairs for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We close today's show remembering the late Mary Martin. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
I don't want to go to school.
I don't want to go to school.
Just to learn to be a parrot.
Just to learn to be a parrot.
And recite a silly rule.
And recite a silly rule.
If growing up means it would be beneath my dignity to climb a tree,
I'll never grow up, never grow up, never grow up.
Not me.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Grateful Dead drummer Mickey Hart tells us about his worldwide exploration of percussion styles and traditions. And we meet John Amiel. He directed Dennis Potter's groundbreaking TV series, The Singing Detective, and the new movie, Tune In Tomorrow. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.